Paul, see how well I do today. Just got off the plane about 1 o'clock in the morning last night after a 9-day trip.
Oh, wow.
But it was an exciting trip. I was in Colorado and North Carolina. And Colorado is at the Colorado School of Mines for a thing that they called Think Week. And as I walked in, I saw all these signs that said Think Week all over the campus. I said, gee, when I was in university, every week was Think Week. What's happened here? But what's special about this is organized by a group of Christians who say, you know, at least 1 week out of the year, we need to encourage students and professors to think about the most important issues of life. And that's what it was all about. They brought in speakers literally from all over America to really engage the students and faculty on what to think about. And I was the origins guy, so I thought, well, being the School of Mines, I should spell origins, O-R-E, but I spoke on the origins of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of humanity. But what was interesting is a discussion that developed over, because I had mentioned just in passing that Genesis talks about three separate origins of life. The origin of purely physical life, the origin of life that's physical and soulish, a reference to the birds and mammals and higher reptiles, and then the one and only species that's body, soul, and spirit, namely us human beings. And that was interesting in that when I went to North Carolina, I was engaging scientists, biologists, where we actually got to talk about something called human exceptionalism. And it's an interesting debate that I wasn't fully aware of, how in the biological scientific arena, there's this idea that we human beings are not so special after all. Because when we look in the higher animals, things that we think are unique human features are present in those animals as well. Although all the speakers there made the clear distinction that when it comes to human beings, we have symbolic capability, and we don't see that at all in the animals that are non-human. And we don't see it in the bipedal primates that preceded us either. No evidence that Neanderthal or Homo erectus, for example, were engaging in symbolic communication. Now, what's been problematic in this debate, there is evidence that the higher animals can vocalize and the higher animals can communicate. And I was kind of sitting there saying, gee, I wonder why it's taking these scientists so long to notice that. I mean, I've had pets all my life, and they seem pretty good at vocalizing and communicating. It's like they're now recognizing, for example, that you can train a variety of animals a limited vocabulary. There is one famous female ape who has a vocabulary of 200 words. However, what's interesting about that particular ape, that ape has been in a strong emotional bond with a human being for 20 years. So it's really not a whole lot different than what you do with a parrot. And what you notice is a parrot can fire back with you a number of words, just like this gorilla is able to recognize different words. I mean, after all, every dog I've ever owned seems to know the word walk. I mean, you have to spell it, otherwise the dog is going to immediately get all excited. And now I've got a dog where my son has a dog where even if I spell it, the dog gets all excited. So.
Wow, that means they have symbolic capability.
Well, that was actually brought up. Does this mean they have symbolic capability? No, I think they're just simply listening to the sounds. So they recognize W-A-L-K, oh boy, I get to go on a walk. So, but there is an acknowledgement that there isn't any real symbolic capability in non-human animals in the sense that no parrot is able to select different words and come out with a unique sentence. It's always something that's been mimicked. And likewise, none of the higher animals, even the raven, is able to put together even a phrase or a sentence. And as I've mentioned here in the class, it's more fundamental than that. No non-human animal can recognize a single symbol that we human beings recognize as having meaning. So, for example, if you drive along the freeway here, you'll see a stop sign, a yield sign, a railroad crossing sign. Try training an animal to recognize what that symbol means. It doesn't work. So, and there's famous stories where, you know, a counting horse, where a horse can do limited arithmetic, or dogs can do limited arithmetic. And research has now shown it's not that they're able to do arithmetic. The owner says to the horse, what's 4 plus 3? And the horse stomps with its foot, but the horse is looking for a signal from its owner when to stop bouncing its hoof. And if you put someone else in its place, then the horse can't do any arithmetic at all. It all has to do with the bond. And this is really what came up in our discussion after the Colorado trip, engaging these biologists, says, notice that you get the most human-like qualities being manifested in these animals when they're bonded to a human being. And when they're not bonded to a human being, the level drops. It's not missing, but it drops. There's a couple of hands, but I want to take the discussion a little further. You're first.
I like that, but I think I've heard, like a Noam Chomsky, that the uniqueness of a human being is that we actually have inherited intelligence. Like we could not possibly learn language from our parents. It's something like delivered directly, like a message from God.
That's something you see in little children. I mean, I saw this with both of my sons. I mean, since I'm on the autistic spectrum, I wasn't talking until I was like 6 or 7. But with each of my boys, 14 months, they were talking in complete sentences.
So it's like inherited.
It's like I didn't have to do a lot to train them. It just happened. I mean, they're wired to be able to develop language and develop very quickly. And when you consider that Adam and Eve in the garden were created full size, I mean, for example, an adult brain is 3 times the size of a baby's brain. And with that full size brain, I think that explains why God was able to communicate with Adam and Eve so quickly. I mean, if you just look at that little child, how quickly they're able to develop communication. And I also noticed, too, with both of my sons when they were just a few months old, it's like before they can speak, they're recognizing my words. So it's like they're able to figure out what I'm saying with my words. Okay, you were second, and there was a hand over here. Yes.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that also with animals, also have to do a lot with their esophagus, something in their throat that maybe,
Well, that's true.
Also another thing is there is a talking animal, that's a talking snake.
Yes.
Well,
if you read the book of Numbers, there's also a talking donkey. And, you know, what you're referring to, I mean, it tells us in Hebrews 13 that many of us have entertained angels unawares. And angels can take any physical form they want. And they don't have to take a physical form. They can go to a donkey and inhabit that donkey and take control over the donkey or take control of the snake. I mean, if you look at the Bible, how many animals are akin to Satan? He's called a dragon, he's called a lion, he's called a snake. The truth is, he could appear in any one of those forms and talk through any one of those forms. Angels can do that.
Except now they can't. They're used to it, I know
that. Well, it happens now too. So, anyway, Ross.
To me, the biggest difference, the one that just blows all the arguments away, is that we animals, for the most part, don't accumulate knowledge from one generation to the next.
Right.
And we do. Those animals that can talk or count or whatever, none of them ever pass that on to their offspring. Take every generation starts over, where with humanity, we don't do that.
Well, like this past few days, we've been in dialogue with anthropologists and biologists who are trying to claim that we're the product of natural descent, common descent from a common ancestor with Homo erectus, with Neanderthal, with the chimpanzees. But yeah, you're making a good point. When you look at the culture of these bipedal primate species that preceded humans, it's constant. The technology at the beginning of the Neanderthal era is the same as at the end. Whereas with humans, we're compulsively inventive. Now, what was interesting is some of the pushback we got. They said, well, we have good data that the first humans date back somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to maybe even 200,000 years, 100,000 years ago. Nothing much seemed to happen. There's a reason why nothing much seems to happen. There was a paper published 2 months ago now. I've made a post on it on my Twitter site, which makes the point that previous to the Neolithic Revolution, which began about 12,000 years ago, we had extreme climate instability. In fact, if you look at the last ice age, I've made shown you graphs here in the class, that just shows that there's extreme temperature swings during the entire ice age cycle, except for the era we're in right now. And because of that extreme climate instability, those extreme temperature swings, it's impossible to develop intensive agriculture. And without intensive agriculture, it's impossible to raise a large human population, have cities, have people specialize. It's basically every family for themselves. It's also impossible to develop any kind of large-scale metallurgy, because there's a lot of debate. When you open up the Bible in Genesis 4, it talks about the pre-flood peoples being able to engage in metallurgy. There's references to them actually farming. But when you have these extreme temperature and climate swings, it's possible to have a 1 or 2 acre farm. And hey, if the crop fails, you get up and you move somewhere else where it's a little warmer or a little colder, or you plant different crops. I mean, the typical mixed farmer of 1,000 years ago might have a 4 acre plot, but on those 4 acres, they grow maybe 8 different food crops, with the expectation that several will fail, but then there'll be enough that you can feed your family. But in order to have the kind of civilization we enjoy today, you really need people specializing. They say, you know what, I'm going to plant 4 square miles of wheat, and I'm going to sell my wheat, and I'm going to use the proceeds from the selling of the wheat to buy pottery, to buy stuff from the metallurgy enterprises going on in that village. I'll trade for goats, I'll trade for sheep. But that can't happen unless you've got climate stability. And that really wasn't recognized in literally until 2 months ago, the impact of extreme climate stability and how it limits agriculture, how it limits metallurgy, and how it limits the building of towns and specialization. And so I would argue there was metallurgy going on before the flood, but at such a low level, it's not going to leave archaeological remains. Likewise, farming was going on, but not at a level that's going to leave any kind of scientific evidence. The first scientific evidence we have, say, for intensive wheat farming is in the northwest part of the Mesopotamian Valley, where they were able to discover that the farmer was actually breeding the wheat seeds to get greater productivity. But there's no value for doing that unless you're growing wheat on a large scale. And so that's kind of the first arc. We don't have the seeds from that era. That's all decayed away, but we do actually have DNA evidence that shows us that there was this, the location and the time when this wheat domestication took place. Yes?
When it said that Cain went to the city of Nod, I believe, what kind of gathering was that? Was that more like a village?
Well, that actually came up yesterday in our discussion. Is okay, Hugh, you're making this claim that we're talking low-level you know, farming and metallurgy, and but didn't Cain build a city in the land of Nod? Well, if we're talking Cain, it can't be. I mean, I take the position, and some of the people at this conference did not take the position, that all of humanity are descended from two individuals. But if all of them were descended from two individuals, Adam and Eve, and the Cain is one of the first children born to Adam and Eve, then there aren't going to be a lot of people around, even after a few generations, to populate as, quote, city. And actually, it could be translated village. So we may be looking at him building, say, a few dozen homes. And this would be the city of Cain. And are we going to find archaeological evidence for that? I don't think so. The earliest evidence we have for villages built by humans is at the very base of the Neolithic Revolution. It's a set of 60 villages that they discovered. By the way, they discovered it just 2 years ago. It's a recent discovery. 60 villages that are right on the shore of the present-day Persian Gulf. And the German archaeologists who discovered it concluded this must be the building of villages in response to the rising of the Persian Gulf. As the sea levels rose, they kept moving their villages up to higher ground, in which case you expect the villages are going to be small. But if you're going to go back to the time of extreme climate instability, the villages will even be smaller. So I use that as an argument that Cain's city in Genesis 4 was really a small village. So So I forget who's next. You, then I'll come back to you.
Getting back to human characteristics, it seems that animals do some tactical planning, and maybe even some strategic planning. How about abstract thinking?
Well, one of the speakers made the point that he actually showed us a photo, and it's an Asian elephant that's doing a painting. And you look at the painting and say, wow, that could be put up in an art museum. This is, you know, sophisticated art. But then the biologist made the point, okay, what they did with the elephant is they put brushes in its snout. And by the way, the elephant's trunk is extremely dexterous, so it's able to hold a variety of brushes. But actually what they did is they put a certain brush and gave that to the elephant's trunk, had him paint a portion of the thing, and then they took the brush away and gave it a different brush with different colors. So you could actually see that the human trainer was guiding the expression of the art. And the whole point is, if you didn't guide the expression of the art by determining what brush and what paint the elephant was going to do, it's not something you want to put up in an art museum. So, and actually, this led to a further part of the discussion. When you look at these incredible accomplishments of these higher animals, note that it's only manifested when the animal has a long, strong emotional bond with a human being. It's a point I've made here in the class before, is that the greatest capabilities of these soulish animals is only manifested when they're bonded to a human being. And the book of Job, it tells us to look to these animals in order to be taught lessons about ourselves and about God. And the point there is, these higher animals, as these birds and mammals, see their full capabilities only manifested when they're bonded to a human being. Likewise, with us human beings, our full capabilities are only manifested when we're emotionally bonded to God. I mean, that's the lesson that Job is talking about. He says, these animals were designed to serve and please you human beings. God gave them incredible endowments so that the relationship we could have with these creatures would be rewarding to the animals and rewarding to us, and enable them to serve and please us at that high of a level. But he says, guess what? You're created the same way. God also created you to serve and please a higher being. And just like with these animals, their capabilities are only fully manifested when they're bonded to a human being. Likewise, your capabilities are only going to be maximally manifested when you're bonded to a human being. And you've heard me say this before, in many respects, 21st century civilization is more ignorant about science than people lived 4,000 years ago, because the vast majority of humanity is simply out of touch with these animals that God told us to look to gain instruction about ourselves, about God, and how we can come into a relationship with Him. And before I take any more questions, kind of one biologist there showed us a video clip. And it's a video, you probably can find it on the internet. I was trying to get it ready for you today. I didn't have enough time to get it set up. I might be able to bring it next week. But it shows two bonobos. Everybody know what bonobos are? They're kind of like, they're relatively large monkeys. They stand about this high. They're very intelligent. I mean, they're right up there with the chimpanzees. But what's interesting is, unlike chimpanzees, they're able to bond more strongly with human beings. So it's much easier to make a pet out of a bonobo than it is out of a chimpanzee. But the video clip shows these two bonobos in a cage. And the human that is bonded to these bonobos comes up to one of the bonobos and gives them sliced cucumbers. Now, bonobos will eat sliced cucumbers, but it's not their favorite food. Their favorite food is grapes. And it sounds like some of you have seen this video clip. And so what the human that's bonded to the bonobos does, he goes to one of the bonobos and then feeds them these little slices of cucumbers. And the ape says, oh yeah, I'll eat them. And he starts eating them one after the other. But then what the human does, he has this bowl of big, fresh grapes. And the one that's been eating the cucumber sees that bowl. Only what the human does, instead of going to that bonobo, goes to the other bonobo and starts feeding it grapes. And of course, that bonobo is getting all excited. and then goes back to the other bonobo and doesn't give him grapes, gives him more cucumbers. Now, what happens next is the one that's getting the cucumbers throws a big tantrum. Gets all upset, starts pounding on the walls and pounding on the cage, grabs one of the cucumber slices and throws it in the face of the human owner. Now, the problem with this, people have looked at that kind of behavior, and you see it in other animals as well, especially with the bonobos, and they say, that shows these animals, just like us human beings, have morality, because you're seen as an expression of fairness. Now, the biologist who's making this point has said, no, wait a minute. I've had pets all my life. He said, well, yeah, I've got a pet dog and a pet cat, too. And I said, well, guess what? I've done that same experiment with our dog and our cat, and I get the same kind of tantrum. Now, not exactly the same kind of tantrum, because a bonobo is more tantrum expressive than a cat or a dog. I mean, after all, they're more intelligent, they got arms, they can do stuff that a dog and a cat can't do. But I imagine several of you have also had that experience. It's most easily manifested when, say, you've got two cats or two dogs, if they're members of the same species. That's where you see it most strongly in the bonded, is that if you show favoritism to one, the other one will react. And so my argument is, it's not just in the bonobos. It's ubiquitous to all the nephesh animals. They'll all behave that way. What's unique about the bonobos is their ability to express their displeasure. But guess what? You can do this with the gerbils, and you'll get an expression of displeasure, just not as dramatic. Pardon me? Well, the secret is you need to find foods that they're willing to eat, and then a food that's basically their favorite. So, like, say if you're doing guinea pigs, I'd say broccoli florets are probably their most favorite food. That they, like us, they need vitamin C. So orange slices or whatever, they really go for that. But then give them something that they'll tolerate, but it's not their favorite food, it'll work. But my whole point is, you even see it with different species, like your pet dog and your pet cat. You'll even see it there. It doesn't need to be a member of the same species. But here's what's critical. You really only see it when both animals are bonded to a human being. Take away the human bond. That was interesting. The biologist I was engaging on this said, yeah, you're right. If there isn't a human component, you don't see it. And it's not that the animal is moral. It's what they're doing is that they have this capacity to form a strong bond with a human being. And what they're really concerned about is my bond as strong as the bond of that other animal? That's what's really going on. And so, and by the way, you see that with human beings too. But there's been numerous experiments done to really test, are animals moral, or is morality unique to human beings? And probably the most definitive experiments is one I describe in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, is where they did it with dogs. Because dogs are the prime example of biologists raised to say, dogs are moral just like we are, because they experience guilt just like we do. And, if a dog does something bad and you scold the dog will take on the guilty look. But as I described in the book, they did experiments at Boston College where they took the human owner out of the way and replaced it with, a piece of cardboard or whatever, or a voice. And what they discovered is the dog didn't respond at all. They got a random response. And the other thing they did is they noticed if the human that's bonded to the dog scolds the dog when the dog did something good rather than something bad in the context of the human owner, the dog still takes on the guilty look. What the dog is doing is trying to please its owner. Okay, my owner's going to be most pleased if I look repentant and guilty. So they put that look on. It's not that they're repentant and guilty, they're trying to make their owner happy. And that's what makes their owner happy. And also explains what they call the mean dog syndrome, where you got a dog that is mean. I mean, one of the biologists made the comment at this conference that says, there's this big debate. Are dogs going to be with us in heaven? I said, I can think of some dogs I don't want to be with. I really don't want that dog going to heaven. But again, what's really going on here, you get a mean dog owned by a mean owner. And, think of pit bulls. I've run into pit bulls that are the most affectionate and gentle animals you can imagine. But guess what? They're owned by very gentle and affectionate people. And I've also seen pit bulls that would want to tear me apart, tear my limbs off and devour me. They're owned by people who have the same behavior. Basically, what that pit bull is doing is saying, oh, my owner is mean and ornery and wants me to behave in a mean and ornery way so to please its owner. It's mean and ornery and attacks everything in its sight because that's what gets the owner really excited. And so, which explains, too, why when you have the Israelites going around Jericho 7 times, what does God tell them? When you enter the city, not only must you kill all the people, you've got to kill all their animals. Because these people are so wicked and so reprobate that even the animals are beyond any hope of redemption. And if you save the animals, they're going to be just like those mean pit bulls that are going to try to kill everything in sight. But notice when they came to other cities, Lord said to the Israelites, save all the animals or save all the children.
Save all the women too.
Sometimes save all the women. It all depended on the level of reprobation that city. And this really shows the mercy of God. He examines the city and says, this is where the reprobate level lies. He says, only take care of the reprobation. And you say, why does God want the reprobation taken care of? It's a message you see in Romans 1. Is that human reprobation is like a malignant tumor. It's a disease. As it says at the end of Romans chapter 1, these people are not only wicked, their goal is to get as many other people engaged in their wicked behavior with them. And that's why it refers to that level of wickedness as malignancy and why it must be taken care of. I mean, that's why God says we're to have a police force. That's why we're to have an army. Those are things that God has established to deal with parts of our humanity that are so reprobate they become like a malignant tumor, and unless they're removed, all of society will be wiped out. And that's kind of the story of the flood, where the malignancy got so widespread it was in danger of bringing about the extinction of the entire human species. So God had to go in and do aggressive surgery. Now, we're at a time when the surgery is much less aggressive. That's what you love to do when you go to a doctor and say, you know what, you got a tumor here. It's malignant, but it's small. We could leave it alone. Or you could take it out and say, well, if it's malignant, how about if you take it out? And so that's really what cancer therapy is all about, trying to cure you of the cancer with a minimum amount of invasion. Yes?
Just getting back to your original thing about the different ice ages and stuff, and say man is 200,000 years old. So what you're saying is they had so few and then the different climate wiped them out, and is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying the climate instability wiped them out. The climate instability prevented them from engaging in intensive agriculture. They were not able to specialize their industries. And so basically every family had to make their own clothing, provide their own food, and because of the climate instability, they had to compartmentalize. So they would have animals that they were raising, they would have, say, 8 different crops, but the family had to do it all by themselves, which meant their farms were small. And if the climate extreme got to be too much, they pulled up all their belongings and moved 500 miles away where the climate was more amenable, which meant they had to have a small enough family and small enough catalog of goods that if things got bad with respect to the climate, they could simply take everything they own and move, which is difficult to do if you've got 4 square miles of wheat and you've got equipment and you've got people that you're employing and you've got roads so that you can deliver your goods to market. That's not susceptible or that's not sustainable if you've got climate instability.
So, which is the other thing that as you go on, how does that then line up with, say, the flood, like our things about 30,000 years ago, or the Tower of Babel, and how does that line up from the timeline of the 200?
Right. Well, that was actually part of the debate we had over the past few days. When did God create Adam and Eve? When did the flood take place? And there are people speculating that because we don't see humanity accomplishing much until the Neolithic Revolution, that maybe that's when we were evolving from a common ancestor with Neanderthal and Homo erectus, etc. In other words, true humans didn't really come upon the scene until 12,000 years ago. Our position at Reasons to Believe is that they far predated the Neolithic Revolution, because you see in the biblical text, and I put this in print in my book Navigating Genesis, how with the flood account, you see that it takes 7.5 months for the flood waters to recede. It wouldn't take that long today, because there simply wouldn't be the pack of ice and snow that could be melted sufficiently to replace the water that flows out of that region into the Indian Ocean. It's kind of what happened in the Mississippi Valley some 25 years ago, where for a 4-month period there was 50 feet of water overlaying the Mississippi Valley, and it stretched on for hundreds of miles. And you say, well, wouldn't that water just flow out into the Gulf of Mexico? It did. Lots of water flowed out of the Gulf of Mexico. The problem was it was being replaced by aggressive snowmelt. That was the year we had a record snowfall, and then heat came in right about now. It was early May when they had a heat wave, and all that snow melted all at once, and so all this water kind of filled up the Mississippi Valley, and it stayed there literally for a 4-month period. Why? Because there was 4 months of snowmelt that continued. So as the water ran out into the Gulf of Mexico, it was replaced by snowmelt. Well, my point about the flood that you see in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9 is that for the flood to remain for 7.5 months, it would mean that there have to be substantial melting of snow and ice to replace the water that flowed out, which means you've got to be in the last ice age, because today the mountains in that region have no ice and snow on them at all. The only vestige of ice that's left is a little tiny spot on top of Mount Ararat. That's not enough to explain the description that we see in the text. And likewise with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, it says that four rivers come together in the Garden of Eden. It names the rivers and tells you where the rivers flow from. By the way, I was engaging some younger creationists on this when I was in Colorado, and they said, well, you know, notice here in America, we put names of European cities in our cities. So you can find a Paris here in the United States. There's a London here in the United States. And I said, yeah, they do that in Canada too. There's a London, Ontario in Canada. And he said, well, that's what happened. All these place names you see in Genesis 2 are meaningless, because people just attach new names to new geographical features. But notice what we see in Genesis 2. It's very careful to mention the names of the rivers, and two of the rivers for sure we know, because it mentions the Tigris and Euphrates, but not only does that, it tells you where the rivers flow from. So it's giving you the location of where those rivers flow from, and you can look at a map today and identify those regions, and you can see two rivers still flowing and two rivers that have stopped flowing. The riverbeds are still there. But I would argue that shows that the account of the Garden of Eden must have been in the last ice age, because you need melting snow and ice to feed the Gihon and the Pishon, and today that ice and snow simply doesn't exist. But it existed 12,000 years ago. Those rivers were flowing at that time. They were flowing throughout the entire ice age back to 120,000 years. So that means, in my opinion, that the story of the Garden of Eden has to be somewhere between 12,000 years ago and 120,000 years ago in order to have those rivers flowing from those locations and meeting in the Garden of Eden. And the meeting place is a problem as well for a recent date for Adam and Eve, because the only place those four rivers come together is in what's now the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf, which today is under 300 feet of water, but during the last ice age, it was dry land. And also explains why Adam and Eve are so comfortable wearing no clothes. I mean, it's warm enough there and humid enough there, you can be comfortable without wearing clothes. Whereas the traditional site in some interpretations is saying, well, I think that's referring to the headwaters. The text English translations actually use the word headwaters, but it could also mean not only the source of those rivers, but also where the rivers meet and separate. In fact, I wound up writing an article that's going to be going up on our website within a few weeks because somebody was complaining. I got that all wrong, that the text says that they're the headwaters. And I said, well, it's a Hebrew word. It's got a broader definition in English. And if you're really right that it's the headwaters, that means the Garden of Eden is on top of Mount Ararat. And also means that you've got the Gihon and the Pishon flowing from there, and it doesn't match the geographical description, which says they come out of Cush and they come out of Havilah. And I dare you to try to live very long without clothes at that high of an altitude. Okay, I think you're first, and I'll come to you. Go ahead.
Dr. Ross, just take the Bible story for what it is. Maybe it's a completely true thing. That humanity was here from the beginning. And in Genesis, we have two creation stories. Maybe take that inference, you know, push it a little bit, that maybe the wrath of God has been real, repeated. So, you know, when you say we don't have a lot of evidence of human activity, maybe it's been wiped out, you know, like flood after flood, and then there's some geological evidence for some glacial things like that, glacial things that explode, like here in North Dakota, I think. There's some weird valleys that have these weird vortices in it. You're familiar with this stuff? So, it's like a thought experiment, of course, that, or genocide, you know, we'd like to do the genocide on us, like the ISIL is killing a lot of people, we're killing a lot of people. So maybe warfare or genocide is an interesting way of wiping out other people, and so like there's no evidence because we've blown it all up in the past. It's interesting.
Yeah, well, my point is whether that was going on or not, and I do agree that the death rate for murder was very high in the days before the flood. The fact that you've got a low population with virtually, limited technology, where it's basically family technology only, that explains why there's no recoverable evidence. I mean, for example, they really didn't find any evidence for wheat farming until they found a place where they were actually cultivating square miles of land and actually breeding the wheat to get higher productivity. That's when they were actually able to get a DNA signal that said, hey, this is where it happens. But a lot of people have read those papers and think that's a paper proving the birth of agriculture. It's not. It's the birth of big-time agriculture where you're specializing. That's really the only scientific way you're going to be able to uncover the evidence. If somebody living 50,000 years ago has got a 4-acre farm where they're growing 8 different crops and they're not breeding the seeds, and they got a whole bunch of, they might have a few donkeys, a few goats, a few sheep, but they're not breeding them, there will be no scientific signal you can recover at this time. It's simply at way too low a level and far too back in the past. So, I would expect there wouldn't be anything. On the other hand, I dispute the idea that humans at that time weren't as smart as we are and weren't as intellectually capable or as dexterous as we are. They were simply limited by the climate instability. Put all of you back in that kind of a context, you're not going to do any better than what they did. That's going to be the limit. And that's basically what these recent research papers are publishing. They're just saying, given the degree of climate instability, that would be the limit of human capability, no matter how intelligent these individuals would be. Yes?
Yeah, following directly on that is the implication then that in that time, human civilization wasn't able to develop above this very primitive level, but now that we are at a much higher level now, and I think you've covered this in weeks past, that if we go into a period of climate instability again, that we will not be able to maintain our current civilization just for that reason.
Right.
We can't maintain the agriculture and the whole food chain specialization thing would break down. So this is something I think that the climate change
people
are glomming onto right now, and considering that you've been talking about the fact that we've got this unique period of climate stability right now and that that's likely to change in the future, I'm trying to see how to respond to these climate people who are now very much glomming onto the idea that climate change we're seeing now is 100% human oriented, and we've got to kill it. We've got to do whatever we can. When, as you have said, our impact is between 20 and 80%, and depending where it is, depends on how much effort, I suppose, we should, or how much effect we could have on that.
Well, the very
how
last...
How to respond to these people, that's kind of what's bothering me.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I did an event in North Carolina a couple nights ago. I didn't realize it, but a guy who was on the United Nations Commission for Climate Change was in the audience. And he said, this is stuff we got it. So he's basically wanting to have reasons to believe, work with him, and go to New York and D.C. and actually kind of make this case that climate instability is the norm. What we have in terms of extreme climate stability is an exception. And so without any human activity at all, we're going to be entering into a period of climate instability. But I think what's interesting, these papers that are being published have basically been motivated by the fact that, what I found interesting is that nobody really did these kinds of studies until we came up with this crisis about global warming that we're facing now. And they said, gee, let's go back and see if this is actually a problem for agriculture. And they said, yeah, it's a big problem for agriculture. But that kind of research should have been done 100 and 200 years ago. But there was no motivation to do that research because people assumed that the climate stability we had was permanent. It's not permanent.
So then again, how do we respond to the increasing snow, steamrolling, I guess, of the idea that this is a human problem, human-caused problem, that we humans have to solve it? We don't just back off and say, well, it's natural. We have to...
Well, kind of what came up in this event two nights ago is that the Bible, right in the first chapter, says that we're stewards of the planet. We're to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. You go to the book of Job, and you've got basically a three-chapter-long creation care manual. But it is making the point that God has, put us here at a unique time. So I think we need to kind of make that point. This is a unique time. It's unprecedented. We've never had this extraordinary climate stability before. And first of all, I would argue we need to express gratefulness for our Creator Lord for actually giving us this incredible period of stability for as long as it has. The fact that it's lasted 9,000 years is nothing short of a miracle. So in that sense, giving credit where credit is due and recognizing, yes, there may be things we human beings can do to stave it off a little bit, but it is inevitable that the climate instability will return. No matter what we do, it's going to return. And we've got to be cautious not to do so much that we give it more harm than good. I mean, it's like that with trying to, quote, save endangered species. Sometimes our efforts to save an endangered species winds up wiping out several other species. And so we can do too much. And we need to realize what is the natural norm. So, like, for example, with species, we know that without human impact at all, you're going to have at least one species going extinct every year. That is the natural norm independent of humanity. So if you have a group that says, our goal is to have no species extinctions whatsoever, they're going to wind up doing more harm than good. Better yet to say, let's have a goal of reducing species extinction down to just a handful a year. And better yet, how about an average of one a year? I mean, that's an achievable goal. But by going after a goal that's not achievable, you do more harm than good. And I would argue the same thing's true. But by the way, what got the attention of this guy from the UN is the fact that he could see from Reasons to Believe, we were saying there are things that we can do to extend climate stability that's not going to cause draconian economic sacrifices on the part of humanity. And he was a Christian. He picked this up right away and said, you're right. There's no way we can legislate poverty to the world population. Go to everybody and say, we want you to lower your standard of living by a factor of 10. I mean, how much support are you going to get from that? And, I've done experiments with my own son, say, if we wanted to extend human longevity on this planet, what do you think about reducing your standard of living down to 1% of where it is now and giving up all your technology? And they basically say, we would rather see the human species go extinct. And I think that kind of attitude is pretty pervasive. I mean, once you get your hands on wealth and technology, it's quite reluctant to give it up. That's been the human state for a long time. That's just the way we are. But I think what got the attention of this guy from the UN, there's actually steps we can take that will actually boost the economy and at the same time help extend climate stability. And he says, That's a no-brainer. Everybody's going to vote for it. Everybody's going to like it. They got more wealth, they got more technology, and they got more climate stability. But no matter what we do, it's simply inevitable that the climate instability will return. Now, from a Christian perspective, what that tells me is we have a limited amount of time to take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. We need to get on with the most important task that God has given to humanity. And incidentally, that was part of the discussion we had. Why did God give humanity these exceptional capabilities? And why did he give these animals these exceptional capabilities? And I thought what was interesting was that many were not recognizing we human beings would not be where we are today if God hadn't given us these exceptional animals. A lot of them had this idea that we could have launched our civilization without any animal help at all. I think the proof for that is, look at what happened to the humans that settled in North America, South America, and Australia. Now, the place where you see the greatest advance was here in North America. But of those three continents, North America suffered the least extinction of large bird and mammal species when humans entered into North America. The extinction rate was 73%. For South America, it was 79%. For Australia, it was 94%. And what you can notice in those different continents, it was the Australians that had the least level of civilization and technology and the lowest population. They were not able to have a large population because they simply couldn't sustain enough culture and civilization, and they remained in a quite primitive Stone Age culture. The Indians here in North America, they had some limited agriculture, quite limited. But because they lacked the horses, because they lacked the cows and the donkeys that the Europeans and the Asians and the Africans had, they were never able to launch themselves out of the Stone Age technology. Where what we see in Africa and Europe and Asia is that civilization rapidly advanced. The other point I want to make before I take another question, notice how quickly human civilization vaulted once we had climate stability. So I'm basically arguing there was this pent-up energy to launch civilization, but it had to wait till we had climate stability. And once we had it, it just exploded upon the scene. And likewise, you can see that with the scientific revolution. Once people took the scientific method out of the Bible and began to apply it to their scientific endeavor, there was an explosion that we're experiencing to this day. Or you can go back to the very origins of humanity. They have recovered the tools of the first humans. And what you'd notice is you go from what you see with the Neanderthals, where they would take a rock and smash it against another rock and get a sharp edge that they could scrape meat off bones. With the first humans, what you see is wooden handles with shaped stones, stones that have been sharpened by being put in fire, and then you see sinew that's been wound around it to make an axe and a shovel, and it happens very quickly. And you see sewing implements. In fact, what was interesting, there was a lot of debate going on. We think Neanderthals wore clothes just like humans did. So I said, well, what's the evidence? And they said, well, the evidence is that the Neanderthals couldn't have kept themselves warm enough if they weren't wearing clothes, given where we found them living. And I said, well, wait a minute. That's that time when the climate was going up and down like that. Do you really know the temperature that these Neanderthals were experiencing? It could have been a lot warmer than what you think. And moreover, you dare not try to analyze this in the context of human physiology. Because you look at Neanderthal physiology, they have a barrel-shaped rib structure, short limbs, and an extremely large nasal capacity, all of which is designed to help them live in a cold climate without clothes. So in that sense, I'm not too impressed. And moreover, you actually see humans living at the south tip of South America with no clothes. It's really cold down there, average temperature 40 degrees Fahrenheit, but they're able to live there without clothes. Why? Because they were able to raise their body metabolism to a point where they could survive there. And that's not too big of a surprise. I don't know about you, but when I'm out there hiking and a really cold rain comes down, it's 40 degrees, and I'm soaked, you know how I deal with that? I run. that generates enough body heat that in spite of all this water coming down on me and freezing me, I'm expending enough heat that I can keep my body warm until I get to the car. I'm sure a lot of you have done the same thing. By the way, if you ever feel that hyperthermia is coming on, that's how you deal with it. You get moving at a high rate. That assumes, of course, that you've got enough reserves within you that you can expend that kind of heat. So it's not a good idea to be out in the cold for 3 or 4 days, because now you're not going to have the reserves. But the whole point is, I think, and by the way, with the Neanderthals, no sewing implements have ever been discovered. And we haven't found any clothes either. No clothes, no sewing implements, and no evidence that they had the tool technology to actually make any kind of clothing. Although I would argue, because they had scraping instruments, it's possible that they could have killed a bear and scraped all the meat off the bones of the bear, scraped all the fat off the skin of the bear, and kind of made a robe that they could put over themselves. That's a little bit different than the clothes that all of you are wearing. I mean, notice it took some sophisticated technology for you to put the clothes on that you did to come to class this morning. Okay, you're first, step back to you, then back to you, and we'll get around to all of you. And by the way, if there's hands here, it's because my peripheral vision isn't catching it. But you're first.
Regarding the Stone Age culture of Indians, especially Central and South America, what explanation is there for seeming deception to that in some of the pyramid structures and other structures that they built, the stone 20 tons, 40 tons, that precision of cutting, you can't even put a piece of paper through adjoining blocks. It's so precise.
Right.
What's that all about?
Well, a lot of Stone Age cultures have been able to pull that off. If you're prepared to put enough labor toward the project, you can make that happen. So what you see there in the South American pyramids, that was all done with Stone Age technology. The only metallurgy that they had achieved was gold. But it's not really metallurgy, because what you're doing is you're finding nuggets of pure gold. So you're not really smelting it or, you know, putting it in any kind of manufactured form. And certainly a gold hammer isn't going to help you much, or a gold chisel isn't going to help you much with that. They actually use sharp rocks to try to cut other rocks to make those blocks. Now, from today's perspective, the labor is so expensive, we would never do it. But back then, hey, let's just, you know, go after that village over there and take them all as slaves. Let's do that with 100 other villages. And now we got 50,000 slaves. We're going to work them for 60 years, and you can build quite an amazing structure if you've got that kind of labor talent. Okay, you're in the back. Yeah.
Back to this instability, climate stability, and then when you said several occasions that you might be nearing that where it becomes unstable. How quickly will that instability occur? And in other words, are we talking about months, years, decades?
Okay, when climate instability does kick in, and some have actually argued it's starting to kick in already, you're basically looking at a century or two before things really get nasty. So, for example, there's some evidence that the Gulf Stream might be shutting down. That would be really bad news for Western Europe. And there's some evidence, too, that the first, like if you look at the past ice ages, the first sign of a coming ice age is when ice begins to build up over Labrador. And so people are saying we need to actually have stations in Labrador so that we can actually see when this is starting to happen. Some have argued that it is happening, but a lot of people are saying we don't think so. But that means that we need to actually have stations there so we can measure it. What they are noticing is that winters in Western Europe are getting more severe, and so that may be a sign that the Gulf Stream is shutting down. But when it does, it's going to take about 150 years before. So that means it's not going to be months. It's not going to be years. And it's a debate right now whether we are kicking into climate instability or not. We just don't know. But that's one of the problems. It's such a complex science that our inability to accurately draw conclusions could be our worst problem, because we may be beyond the tipping point and not know it. Okay, you were next, then I'll get back to you. Yeah.
get back to the first book of the Bible? What is it?
Genesis.
Well, Adam and Eve, as far as I can determine from what I read, is they did not know that they were naked until the snake told them to bite the apple, and then all of a sudden they decided, we're naked. Okay? The second one is, in one of your trips, take a trip to the Neander Valley in Germany, and you'll see a whole museum there of the Neanderthals. And they have villages, kind of like the village that you see in a Native American village here. They had kind of like teepees. They were made of furs and hides, and they were clothed in furs and hides. So it must have been pretty cold at that time. So and I've read since we discussed this before, a lot of articles said that they probably did interbreed with humans. So.
Well, that particular museum came up in our discussion, and everybody agreed that the museum is false. There's no way that they were having these villages. Well, basically what discussion I heard, it's a great sales maneuver. But the problem is what they're representing in that museum simply doesn't square with the facts. They did, yeah. They got complete fossils of Neanderthals. They were living in caves. And, in fact, part of our dialogue was, they have found these complex tools in caves with Neanderthal bones. But it was also a cave that was used by humans. And recent dates show that the tools were human tools. They were not Neanderthal tools. But that was a big debate for several years. And also, they noticed that there was this a burial spot in the cave, and what they've now discovered is that it was a natural concave in the cave, and that the body of this Neanderthal naturally went down into there and then got filled over with erosive debris. And so it wasn't a purposeful burial, it was an accidental burial.
Well, it was a mine there, and later on that's why they discovered that it was for mining.
What? That's a different mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, there really isn't any debate about them having, quote, tents. They now realize they didn't have these structures because where we find them living in the most cold climes is in caves. So evidently they were using a cave to protect themselves from the element. They weren't building structures. The other thing we notice is that the earliest humans, at the same time that the Neanderthals were going extinct, were living in climate zones 15 degrees centigrade colder than what the Neanderthals could live in. And the only explanation for that is that the humans, quote, had tents and clothes that the Neanderthals did not. Because, the Neanderthals anatomically are much more capable of living in a cold climate than we are. They got the right size shaped body, short limbs, they got that nasal capacity. So they're much more able to deal with a cold climate than we are, and yet the earliest humans were living in far colder climes than they were. And the only explanation is a difference in technology.
When was the Homo erectus? Were they before or after the...
Neanderthals are about 130,000 years ago to about 50,000 years ago. There's some debate as to when they went extinct. Homo erectus... Some push it back as far as 2 million years. The earliest undisputed date is 1.8 million years. And likewise, there's some dispute as to when they went extinct. Some of the evidence said that they went extinct by 500,000 years ago. Some say they may have persisted to 200,000 years ago. And by the way, that was also part of our debate discussion the last few days, these dates. Well, the truth is, almost all the dates you see in the literature are not accurate dates. And when I say not accurate, your typical error bar is plus or minus 100%. So when they say something's 100,000 years old, it could be between 0 and 200,000 years. So, and that's simply because we typically lack radiometric dating tools. So you're having to use things like thermoluminescence and optical luminescence to try to guess what the dates are. Now, what I think is remarkable, though, when you look at the finds for the earliest humans, there are three lines of evidence that give you dates. You can go to the genealogies in the Bible and get a biblical date. You can go to the cultural evidence and get a date for when human culture first came upon the scene. That's distinct from the culture of these other animals. And also there's a DNA date. All of them are crude. All of them have got error bars of about plus or minus 100%. But what's interesting, they all agree with one another. So the fact is, all three dates, as crude as they are, all come into the same ballpark, which really is, I think, our strongest evidence that humans have not been here for millions of years. They've been here at most, maybe, roughly 100,000 years, and maybe much less than that. And, you know, that used to be a big debate, is no longer a debate. Everybody agrees that humans are relatively recent. Okay. Well, if you go to ancestor.com, they'll probably trace for you that, but you're going to get a visit from a couple of Mormons at your door. So it's free, but maybe not so free. So, but hey, if you want to have an opportunity to share your Christian faith with Mormons, that's a good way to do it. Sign up for ancestry.com or go visit that cultural museum in Hawaii. That also will guarantee you'll get a visit from a couple of Mormons. Yes?
Dr. Ross, interesting stuff about, you know, how cultures have changed. But what about, you know, I'm probably like a Native American, you know, just the way I look. What about if my ancestors didn't really need metal, then we could, like, harness that human potential you're talking about? Like,
okay, now the point I was making is this. That we humans tend to take credit for our civilization and technology. What this book tells us, God gave us specific animals that he designed to be able to help us launch and sustain agriculture, technology.
Like maybe my ancient people, they put their full faith in God, Christ, and they didn't need clothing because they maybe looked like me, a little chunky. You obviously, it's like a blubber, you know, you can survive a little bit better in colder climates with your little fatter. You know, we have like this opinion they're like these emaciated people. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they look like me. Maybe we slept differently, we breathed differently, weighed differently.
Well, here's the one thing we do know.
Potential. Science fiction maybe, but we'll see.
What we do know is that when humans came into Australia, they wiped out 94% of all the large-bodied bird and mammal species. When humans went into sub-Saharan Africa, they only wiped out 4.5%. So 95.5% survived. This is why people sign up for safaris to Africa. That's the place you can go to see all these diverse species of wild animals, because we didn't wipe very many of them out. But in Australia, they did. Australia, you know, had camels and horses, but they got wiped out. And because they wiped out the very animals that God gave us to launch and sustain civilization, they couldn't launch and sustain civilization. I think this is important. There's nothing inferior about the Aborigines in Australia. The problem was they lacked the resources that the Europeans and the Asians had. And so, for example, in Europe, the extinction rate of these large-bodied bird and mammal species was only 30%. In Asia, it was only about 12%. Sub-Saharan Africa, 4.5%. And that explains why civilization flourished on those continents, why the population was able to grow, and the population of technology in North and South America and Europe did not grow. And also what came up in this dialogue, and I'm going to wrap this up soon, is that what's interesting, because there's a big debate, are we really descended from a common ancestor with Neanderthals, Homo erectus, and Australopithecines? It was those very species of life that prevented the mass extinction of bird and mammal species in Africa, Asia, and Europe. Because what's interesting about North and South America and Australia, no evidence for bipedal primates that preceded human beings, zero evidence. The greatest evidence we have is in Africa, and that's where we had the greatest survival rate. So in that sense, if God hadn't created Homo erectus, if he hadn't created Neanderthals, if he hadn't created Homo sapiens idaltu and the Australopithecines, we'd all be in the Stone Age to this day, and the human population would be very limited. And what we see in the book of Revelation, God intends that there be an uncountable number of human beings with him in that new creation, and that requires that we have civilization technology, and we wouldn't have it if God hadn't created those animals and those birds, and he wouldn't have it if he hadn't created those dozen species of bipedal primates that preceded us. And lastly, we argued with these biologists, we know they're specially created because they have adult body sizes bigger than 7 pounds. And there's conservation biology research studies that tell us if the adult body size for a land mammal does not exceed 7 pounds, that species will go extinct before it can evolve into a different species. And all the bipedal primates have an adult body size considerably bigger than 7 pounds. Therefore, like us, they're special creations. Time for announcements. Thank you.
Lord God, you've given us such an amazing planet and an amazing universe that challenges us intellectually, but underneath it all reminds us that we are to come to you in humility and gratitude and joy and thankfulness and amazement at what you've created. And I ask, Lord, that with all of this knowledge that we gain in this class with Dr. Hugh Ross, that we always remember to turn it towards you and also towards other people in love, because we want to share our relationship with you, realizing that apologetics is another tool in our belt to spread the good news. We thank you so much. Bless everyone as they go their way this afternoon. In Jesus' name, amen.